This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Much has been written about the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the support a stronger Taliban provides to al-Qaeda. But my guest, journalist Gretchen Peters, believes far too little attention is being paid to the growing source of cash for the Taliban, the heroin trade. She writes that in 2006, Afghanistan produced the largest illegal narcotics crop a modern nation has ever cultivated in a single harvest, most of it in areas under Taliban control. The Drug Enforcement Administration now estimates that opium provides the Taliban with 70% of its funding. Peters has covered Pakistan and Afghanistan for more than a decade, for the Associated Press and later for ABC News. Her new book, Seeds of Terror, How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, explores the ties between the two organizations and the drug trade. She also looks at the conditions that have nourished its growth, including corruption in the region's governments and the mistakes and inattention of U.S. policymakers. Well, Gretchen Peters, welcome to Fresh Air. There's been enormous attention lately to the resurgence of the Taliban in the region, their increasing level of military activity. To what extent does the Taliban rely on the narcotics trade for their finances?
Well, that is an open question. It's a very difficult question to answer because, in part, the Taliban keeps, as far as anyone knows, very few paper records. I don't know if there's anybody who actually knows what percentage comes from poppy, but the U.S. military and the U.N. calculate that the Taliban earn about $400 million a year off the opium trade. I estimate that they earn as much as $500 million because I add in donations of material, trucks, gasoline, medical supplies, weapons. So I believe the real dollar figure is much higher. Nobody has any idea how much al-Qaeda earns off of the drug trade. But what we can say is that the Taliban and al-Qaeda are earning astonishing sums of money off of criminal activity, largely the drug industry, but also other criminal activity like extortion, kidnapping, other forms of taxation in their communities where they hold sway. But nothing is being done to track that money, and nothing is being done to try and cut off those profits.
All right, let's talk about the drug trade specifically. Now, does the Taliban actually grow the opium? Do they refine it and process it? Do they deal it themselves? Or do they simply tolerate it and make money from those who do?
It varies by region, their level of involvement. In the southern part of Afghanistan, where most poppy is grown, in the southern provinces of Helmand, Kandahar, Nimroz, Farah, in those areas, you see some Taliban commanders who are very much involved in the poppy trade. In some districts, they will try and dictate the poppy output, how much farmers are growing. They will tax the crops. They will tax trucks that are leaving the areas. In other districts, they might just tax the district leader of the area. They might just take money from the traffickers as they leave. So it does seem to vary region by region. But what I have tracked over the last 5 years that I have been studying this issue is that their level of involvement has deepened. And so we now see Taliban commanders who are running their own refineries along the border. We now see increased numbers of commanders, district-level commanders of the Taliban, who are not just taxing shipments of poppy, but they're protecting shipments of poppy. They're actually coming to the protection of refineries when the NATO forces and Afghan anti-drug troops come in to try and shut those drug labs down. We see them expanding vertically through the drugs trade. And this is a pattern of behavior that has also been seen in places like Colombia with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, better known as the FARC.
Now, you mentioned refineries. When you say refineries, you're talking about what, labs that process opium into heroin?
I'm talking about labs that process raw opium, usually into morphine base, that's something that's referred to locally as brown sugar. And when I say refineries, I am not talking about particularly elaborate operations. These are usually mud huts with some plastic drums in them and some workers who are usually very, very high who are mixing chemicals and cooking them with opium. These are very, very rudimentary operations. And increasingly, as NATO troops have moved into southern Afghanistan, I've been getting reports that the refineries are more mobile. They will be built into the back of souped-up Toyota pickup trucks so they can move from one place to another.
And some of these labs you mentioned are actually run by Taliban commanders. They're getting more involved. I guess the most well-known Taliban figure in the West is Mullah Omar. You write that there were rumors, reports that he had a massive stash of opium himself, what, 3,000 tons or something?
Yes. There's a common misperception in the West that the Taliban was anti-poppy because of the 1 year that they banned the cultivation of poppy while they were in power. However, from my research of their movement and how they came to power in the first place, they were very, very close to major trafficking rings that operated along the Afghan-Pakistan border. They continued to tax the poppy trade and the opium as it was trafficked out of the country while they were in power. And while they did ban poppy cultivation for 1 year, they did not extend that ban to the trafficking of the processed opium. So they continued to collect taxes off of that. A lot of the Taliban commanders still today actually collect poppy in kind. They don't collect 10% of the value of the crop. They actually literally will collect 5 or 7 or 8 or 10% of the crop itself. So they will keep these huge stashes of opium. And there has always been this rumor that Mullah Omar himself had an opium stash of several thousand tons that would have been worth well over $1 billion had it ever been smuggled to the West. And nobody's ever found it. However, there have been cases where NATO troops and counter-narcotics forces have come across huge opium stashes when they have broken up Taliban hideouts.
Now, the Taliban that most of us got to know something about in 2001, you know, we thought of them as brutal and terrifying, but as motivated by their own kind of notion of religious piety. Is the Taliban today, which you said is becoming more and more integrated into narcotics and criminal enterprises, has it changed? Is its sense of piety diluted by its contact with the criminal world?
I think the Taliban is becoming more ruthless. I think they're becoming more violent. They're more hated in the communities, the rural communities where they operate. I am certainly not suggesting that they were ever a particularly warm and cuddly bunch. I mean, it was a very, very brutal time, and I traveled all over Afghanistan while they were in power. Things were very, very dire indeed across Afghanistan. But at that point, you could travel across Afghanistan. Anybody could. They provided security. They ruled with an iron fist, but the country was very, very safe. Now, there is just this incredible level of senseless violence. They behead people who they believe are spies. There are people who get hung in the main square of villages that they control and left there for days as a sign of what will happen to anybody who doesn't follow their orders. It's much more like what we see happening in the drug wars of Mexico and Colombia. And that's a point that I try and make in the book, that The war in Afghanistan often gets compared to the war in Iraq, but to my mind, what's happening there is much closer to what we see happening in Latin America, as this insurgent group and other extremist groups that also operate along the border, Al-Qaeda and other Pakistani insurgent groups, as they get sucked into crime, they become more and more violent, more and more ruthless, and they seem to be losing the ideological roots of their movement. When I say that, I do not mean to suggest that I think Al-Qaeda and some of these Pakistani extremist groups have put aside their intention to attack the West and to attack the governments of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Far from it. They appear to be just as determined as ever to wreak havoc in those regions and to try and take power and try and increase the amount of area they control.
And what about the personal lifestyle of the leaders? I mean, do they personally observe Sharia laws and customs, or do they live more like the hedonistic lifestyle of a rich drug dealer?
I haven't found any evidence that people like Mullah Omar are currently living like hedonistic drug dealers. However, certainly the major traffickers who work with them certainly have very lavish lifestyles and hardly behave like pious Muslims. One of the chapters in my book is about a major smuggler who was recently captured, whose name is Haji Juma Khan. He was widely known for having wild and lavish parties that lasted late into the evening with alcohol and prostitutes that were flown in from Russia and around the world. So this was a guy who worked very, very closely with the Taliban, with al-Qaeda, and also with corrupt officials in the Afghan and Pakistani governments. Hardly somebody who sounds like your typical Taliban, though.
Right. I mean, the scale of his empire and power were truly breathtaking. I mean, he had 15,000-man army, bought a town. Is that right?
He at one point bought all the land in a small town in southern Afghanistan. Yes, that's correct.
And created an artificial lake, and this was a way station for his drug convoys, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. You know, we've been talking about the Taliban more. Is al-Qaeda's involvement with the drug trade different from the Taliban? Are they any more ideologically pure? Is Osama bin Laden, do his principles about involvement or distance from the drug trade differ from the Taliban?
The story of al-Qaeda's involvement in the drugs trade is very, very murky, and it's very difficult to pinpoint, in part because U.S. officials have flip-flopped on their opinions of it so many times. Around the beginning of the millennia, around 2000, there were quite a few statements that came out of senior U.S. officials who tracked this issue that they had clear evidence that Osama bin Laden was involved in the drugs trade. Later on, when the Bush administration decided to invade Afghanistan, the way that officials spoke about the drugs trade and al-Qaeda's involvement in it took a 180-degree turn, and it seemed to be something they considered a distraction. And so the decision appeared to have been made to simply deny that al-Qaeda was involved in the drugs trade at all. What my research found along the border was that low-level al-Qaeda operatives appear to help move drug shipments for money as those drug shipments leave Afghanistan. The Taliban is only involved in the drugs industry in Afghanistan within Afghanistan's borders. Once it leaves Afghanistan into Pakistan, Iran, Central Asia, that's when al-Qaeda operatives appear to take over in some circumstances. In some circumstances, it's simply smuggled by traffickers. But there do appear to be cases where al-Qaeda operatives move drug shipments for money. And this is a point where you really stand to make the most money. This is where the value of the drugs goes up about anywhere between 5 and 12 times in value. What I have not been able to determine if these are just cases of al-Qaeda operatives freelancing for money or if this is a sign that al-Qaeda as a movement is trying to earn money through the drugs trade.
You write in the book that the corruption of government officials is key in many countries in allowing the drug trade and these other criminal enterprises to operate. What's the role of the government of Hamid Karzai, the Afghan president, in all this?
Well, the role that corruption plays in fueling the insurgency cannot be underestimated. The Taliban are gaining ground, both in Afghanistan and Pakistan, not because they are so strong or because they are so well-loved. They are not in either country. They are gaining ground because the governments there are so corrupt and so utterly wretched at governing. And so the importance of trying to create better governance in both countries is absolutely critical to fighting this problem. And we're not going to get anywhere in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. We often talk about the drug corruption in Afghanistan. I don't think anybody has looked into the extent to which Pakistan's government has been corrupted by the drug trade as well, because you have to remember that much of the opium that is grown in Afghanistan or produced in Afghanistan is smuggled out through Pakistan. And there is a tremendous corruption problem there as well. And a whole lot more has to be done to create clean governments in both of those countries if we expect to increase the level of stability in that region.
I want to talk about the role of the opium farmers themselves. You know, you begin the book by describing a trip that you took, I think, in 2006 with an opium eradication team from the Afghan military, I believe. And as they set about destroying these poppy fields, the crops in these poppy fields, you saw farmers standing by, these poor farmers, you know, railing at the soldiers, invoking Allah to come and bring down his wrath upon them. A pretty sympathetic picture to these folks. What is the role of the farmers themselves? Do they have any option but to grow opium?
Well, again, it depends where they are. I think that in areas where there is no governance, where the Taliban is in control in southwest Afghanistan, a lot of the farmers really do have very few options. Poppy is a crop that doesn't rot. It's easy to transport. There is an unending demand for it. They can sell it for a lot more money than most legal crops. And if they grow something like melons or grapes, they're likely to get bruised and completely destroyed by the time they travel down Afghanistan's bumpy roads to the nearest market. So a lot of farmers will tell you that they have no choice. In some areas, they have been threatened by the traffickers, by the Taliban, that if they don't grow poppy, they can expect to face dire consequences. I really feel a lot of sympathy for the farmers, and particularly what I feel sympathetic with them about is the fact that so far, most strategy to try to reduce Afghanistan's output has focused on the cultivation side of the drugs trade. And I really think that's a mistake. The farmers are the ones who make money, to what extent they do make money, and that's another very important question. A lot of them really don't profit very much from the poppy trade. Some large farmers do, but the vast majority are just eking by because of the loan structure. It's a very, very difficult market for them. But where the insurgents and the traffickers make money is on the production side, where the opium is produced at the lab end of things, protecting the trade as the convoys leave the region. I believe that NATO and the U.S. government has done very little to try and hit this side of the trade, and this is where it will hurt them in their pocketbooks. We've also done virtually nothing to try and trace the whole money side of the drugs trade, where the money is laundered, where it ends up. There's been virtually nothing done to try and stop that side of the drugs trade. In fact, we've pretty much only focused so far on the production side of the poppy crop. And I think that's a mistake. That's also turned thousands and thousands and thousands of farmers against NATO and the United States.
Well, you know, as I read in many points in the book, you describing military reluctance to act directly against, you know, narcotics traffickers, I had to wonder if part of that is the fact that over the years there have been warlords and others who were allies of the United States who were themselves involved in the drug trade, and that in some respects, you know, we were compromised in going after these targets.
That's certainly true. The U.S. military, the CIA, and other international organizations have at times aligned themselves with warlords, regional commanders who have definite links to the drug trade and other criminal activity. I think another issue that has been a problem here is that there has been this mindset within the U.S. military in particular, and I do see this changing, but there has been this mindset that the insurgency is a military matter and drug smuggling is a problem for law enforcement. There's continually this opinion within our government that the DEA and other counter-narcotics law enforcement officials are the ones who need to deal with the drug problem. However, the military is fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. I contend that this separation leads us to failure. If they're working together, our operations have to be working together. And I also believe that we have to start looking at fighting this insurgency more the way a law enforcement team would fight a criminal gang. We need to figure out how to cut these people off from their profits. That's a central tenet of any successful counterinsurgency strategy. Just last month, the DEA announced that it will now be sending 80 agents to Afghanistan, and I think that's a good start. But what I see a need for is to actually embed law enforcement officials who can collect intelligence, collect evidence in each of the military units that are operating in these areas where the drug trade is taking place. And the Pentagon does appear to realize now that they're going to have to cut off the enemy from this important source of funding.
You know, there's a notion here in the United States that for all of the enormous effort put into the war on drugs, that it's a terrible failure, that for all the surveillance and interdiction and arrests, we have prisons full of people, but the street drug trade continues to flourish because the demand is what really matters. And I'm wondering, I don't know if you agree with that, but what are the implications of that notion for dealing with this in Afghanistan, where we don't have nearly the law enforcement infrastructure and a corrupt government that really is abetting the narcotics trade?
It's going to be unbelievably complex to try and clean up Afghanistan at this point. And I think it can happen, but it's going to take a huge amount of effort, a lot of money, a fair amount of time. One of the reasons the United States has always resisted getting involved in fighting drugs in Afghanistan is because very little of the crop of drugs produced there, either the hashish or the opium, actually ends up in the United States. Our counter-narcotics programs have traditionally focused on stopping drugs from coming to the United States, from stopping our citizens from using them, basically.
But where does the heroin that's used in America come from, if not from the opium in Afghanistan?
The heroin used in the United States generally comes from Latin America. So there were points in recent history, as recently as the 1980s, when about 40% of the heroin sold on U.S. streets came from Pakistan and Afghanistan. That's no longer true. However, I have heard reports that the amount of Afghan heroin being sold in the United States is on the increase, but it's very, very incremental. To me, what's the bigger issue is that insurgent groups who are fighting against U.S. troops in Afghanistan are using money that they get from the drugs trade to attack our soldiers. Every time a U.S. soldier dies in an IED attack in Afghanistan, there's an extremely good chance that opium money paid for that IED. What worries me more is that Al-Qaeda also appears to be profiting from the drugs trade, which means the next time, God forbid, they launch an attack on the United States, there's a very good chance the drug money will pay for that attack.
It certainly underlines the importance of dealing seriously with the problem. And in, I guess, the last chapter to your book, you offer, I guess it's about a 9-point plan that involves, you know, serious interdiction efforts and going after the top criminals, but also things like providing real alternatives for Afghani farmers, for financial monitoring and enforcement on the hawala system of transferring money, dealing with corruption in the government. I mean, it's ambitious and, I guess, pretty expensive. And, you know, we just saw leaders from Afghanistan and Pakistan meet with President Obama. And it was interesting. Having just read your book, I looked at the press reports of following those meetings. And the word opium appeared about 2/3 of the way down. Are policymakers getting it, do you think?
Well, I think officials in Washington recognize how serious the problem is. The challenge that the Obama administration faces is how are they going to finance the efforts it's going to take to turn this situation around. Afghanistan has already gone way up in cost every month, and we're about to send another 17,000 troops out there. This is becoming a very, very expensive operation. And yet everybody in Washington seems to be allergic to the idea of nation building. The way I look at it, Yes, nation building is going to be expensive. A lot of the policies that I recommend they take up will be expensive. It will be very expensive, for example, to try and move poppy farmers onto alternative crops. Subsidizing the legal crops will be expensive. It's already very, very costly. The police reform program that is being undertaken right now. However, the costs that we incur as a nation by continuing to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda in that region are far, far higher. I just think that down the line, the better investment is not to keep trying to kill Taliban and al-Qaeda in the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's to make them irrelevant, to actually create a region that is stable, that has good governance, that has rule of law. That, to me, seems like a better investment. And in addition, it's just the morally right thing to do. These are countries we call our allies, that we are ostensibly trying to help. And yet, whenever I hear officials talk about what they plan to do in those regions, they seem to be trying to reduce our expectations that anything good will come out of it. They seem to be trying to get by doing as little as possible. I think it's going to be less expensive in the long run to try and really turn these countries into stable places to live.
Well, Gretchen Peters, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No problem.
Gretchen Peters' book is called Seeds of Terror: How Heroin is Bankrolling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. At least 140 American soldiers committed suicide last year, giving the Army its highest suicide rate in decades. One military leader who's taken a lead in addressing the issue is our next guest, General Mark Graham, commander of Fort Carson, Colorado. Graham's experience with the issue is personal. In June 2003, his son Kevin, a promising ROTC cadet at the University of Kentucky, took his own life after battling depression. Graham's older son Jeff was killed in action in Iraq 8 months later. General Graham has worked as a commander and advocate to heighten the military's awareness of stress and mental illness among its soldiers and to improve their treatment. Well, General Graham, welcome to Fresh Air. Before military suicide affected you personally, was this a problem that you were aware of as a soldier or a commander?
Well, I was, certainly not to the extent I am now. You know, for years, since I've been in the Army, we've done suicide prevention classes. But I have to tell you, before, you know, years ago, suicide prevention classes were one of many required classes that you gave. And we put the soldiers in a classroom and we gave them a pretty standard briefing. It was a 30-minute thing on suicide. And I mean, frankly, it was okay. It wasn't very dynamic, and it wasn't some units I'm sure did a lot better than others, but it was one of those, okay, here we go, got another class it's mandatory, required to do. You know, I mean, I guess the phrase to me today is you know, we get it, and we're doing a lot more about it, and we recognize that investigating a suicide after it's over is important to do to see what you can learn from it. But what we really want to do is to get left of this and to prevent suicides.
When you say get left of it, you mean get out in front of it, right?
Yes, yeah. Get left of it. You often hear us say, right, you know, get left of the boom. We want to get left of the event, and right, exactly right, get out in front of it so we can prevent these. Because oftentimes when you go back and look at suicide, as is with my wife and I with our son Kevin, when you go back and look at it, you see the warning signs that were there, and you just don't understand, why didn't we see this coming? Why, you know, why didn't we know this?
Let's talk about your son Kevin. In 2003, he was a 21-year-old ROTC cadet at the University of Kentucky, wanted to be an Army doctor, right?
Yes.
Soldier of great promise, right? Selected for airborne training. At the time of his suicide, I believe you were stationed in Korea.
Correct.
Looking back on it, what understanding do you feel you have about what Kevin was going through that might have led to this?
I don't think I can even imagine what he was going through. The pain he was going through and his feelings and his sometimes hopelessness, I don't think I can even fathom what he was going through. I can tell you, it took me a long time before I could ever speak about suicide. But I did speak one day, probably a year and a half after Kevin died. I spoke to a group on a Saturday morning, And afterward, I had a man come up to me, and this man came up to me and said, you know, thank you for speaking out. Thank you for saying something about suicide. And of course, I was very emotional. It was pretty hard, and it was the first time I'd spoken. And he looked at me and he said, he goes, you know, General, I've tried to take my life three times. He said, but let me tell you, because he goes, I do understand what your son was going through. And let me explain to you. It's like being in a dark tunnel and you keep looking to the end of the tunnel to see any light, and there is no light. And he said, it's the most excruciating, worst pain you could ever imagine. And all you're thinking about is getting out of the pain right now. And he goes, that's what you go through when you go through this with depression. And he said, I just want to let you know that so you're aware of what a little bit of what your son was going through. And I'll tell you, that man helped me right then in a way that it's been very comforting to me to at least understand it a little better. You know, I oftentimes tell people, you know, our sons both died fighting different battles. And I clearly believe Kevin died fighting a battle with depression and lost the fight.
You know, I have to say, I mean, I can only imagine how difficult it must be for you to talk about this. Few things are more heartbreaking than the suicide of a young person, and particularly one's own child. But I know that you have a deep commitment to trying to deal with these issues in the military. And as we look at that, you know, I know that Kevin, you were aware of his depression, and he had been receiving treatment from it. Now, I read that he had stopped taking the medication. In looking back at that, I wonder if you think the way that the Army dealt with people who were taking medications for mental and emotional issues made it more likely that he would have abruptly stopped taking it, and whether that might have contributed to the outcome.
Well, I think that's part of the stigma. Whether it was the Army or just society in general, it was part of the stigma to be on medication, to be on medication for depression. And also, I know there were side effects that Kevin probably didn't like as well. But I mean, one time he even told his mom, he said, Mom, I don't want to have to take a pill to be happy the rest of my life. So those should have been key warning signs for us to know hey, this is going down a slippery slope here in a road that's not good. But we heard it. We listened to him. He was getting counseling. He was on medication, but he did come off the meds. We understand. And that's one thing I try to tell people about depression medicine is sometimes it takes a while for it to start taking effect and it starts to work. And then they think, well, I'm better now. And they stop taking it. And you can't do that. You need to go back to your doctor before you change anything with your medications, whether you come off it or stop and taper off or whatever. You got to go see a doctor first because it's very dangerous to do that. So I think that was just part of the stigma with Kevin is, you know, not wanting someone to know he was on that.
It was less than a year after Kevin's death that your older son, Jeff, was killed while on patrol in Iraq. And, of course, people treat servicemen and women who were killed in action as heroes. And I'm wondering if you were struck by any differences in the way people dealt with you about the differences in the deaths of your two sons.
Absolutely. There's no comparison. You know, it's and I'll quote my wife here. When my wife says sometimes, you know, we thought we were the worst parents in the world when we lost Kevin. And then the same parents treating our kids, you know, raising our kids the best we can the same way. 8 months later, we lose Jeffrey in Iraq, and people said he was a hero, that he helped save lives of his platoon. They were both heroes to us. They were both great young men. And you're right. When we lost Kevin, you know, you didn't see anything like you did when we lost Jeffrey.
So let's talk about some of the ways the Army needs to change. The military functions on discipline. You know, in battlefield situations, there has to be no question about people obeying commanders and following orders. But that tends to create, you know, a macho ethic, and one which sort of says you got to suck it up. You got to be tough. What are some of the specific ways? What are some of the ways you think the military culture needs to change, and how do you make that happen?
Well, I think we're doing it now. I mean, I think we're making that happen, and senior leaders in the military are clearly doing that. One is just by their speaking out and letting people know. But the Army has some programs that the Army is using to help others. A huge piece of the stigma is getting leaders from the senior leaders all the way down to the youngest soldiers to know more about it, to understand, depression, to understand suicide prevention, to help their buddies. For example, if a soldier breaks a leg or gets injured or gets shot in combat, soldiers know what to do. They call for the medic to get even additional support, and then they get that soldier to care. Well, we need to continue to help our soldiers understand the risk signs and the warning signs of depression or of potential suicide so that we can get that soldier to care before they get hurt. You wear body armor to protect you before you get shot, but once you get shot or you get injured or something with shrapnel or anything else, you get them to care. So we need to arm our soldiers with information so that they are aware. Hey, if you see your buddy doing these things or you hear your buddy saying these sort of things, those are warning signs that your buddy's reaching out or your buddy's telling you that he's going through something. You need to get him to care.
You know, one way to change behavior in any organization is to change how that organization, rewards and punishes behavior. And I'm wondering if there's been any effort to either commend or promote commanders who are particularly sensitive and help soldiers who are in mental or emotional trouble, or cases where people have been demoted or transferred or reprimanded or in some way held accountable for not giving soldiers help that they need.
Well, I mean, I think this is part of the overall big picture for the Army and how we do business, and it needs to be something that commanders do think about, and I think they do. I mean, I think the awareness is more now than it's ever been in our Army, and I think commanders are seeing that sometimes, and what we're trying to do now is help our junior commanders understand and see. For me, it's to see better. If you have a soldier that's coming to you for an alcohol issue, they got in trouble for a DUI or a drug offense, I know you're going to do good order and discipline. You've got to do something. You can't condone that. But step back from it. Make sure you get them into a substance abuse program. But also step back and look at it and say, is there more to this?
The issue of military suicides has gotten a lot of media attention over the last year or two. But when you began raising this issue a few years back, it was probably less widely talked about. And I wonder if, as you began talking about this within the military, if other commanders ever might have felt other commanders ever looked at you as someone who, under the weight of personal tragedy, had lost perspective or gone soft or had undervalued the importance of military discipline. Did you ever get that sense from folks as you tried to raise this issue?
No. I'm not. When we lost Kevin, our military family is, the Army seems like a huge organization, but I can tell you the Army gets pretty small pretty fast. And when we lost Kevin, the Army was there for us every step of the way. It was pretty tremendous. Our own family, I think, was even taken aback a little bit about how great the Army was to us and how supportive they were to us when we lost Kevin to suicide. The ROTC detachment at the University of Kentucky, the active Army, everyone was wonderful. And the Army even told my son Jeff, Major General Terry Tucker was the commanding general of Fort Knox, Kentucky at the time, and he even told my son Jeff, who was scheduled to go to Fort Riley to deploy with a unit from the 1st Infantry Division. General Tucker told my son, you don't have to go that assignment. We'll keep you here at Fort Knox and we'll give you a different job, but you've been through a tragedy in your family. And if you want to stay here, we will keep you here and you won't have to deploy here. And my son told him, thank you very much, but he said, I need to go. I need to go be with my men. So as a dad, that was hard. As a soldier, I understood why my son made that decision. But as a father, that was a hard one for me. Because as a dad, if Jeff would have stayed, and wouldn't have deployed, what would have happened? But, I do believe there is a plan out there. I don't get to vote on it, but I do believe there is one.
Mm-hmm. General Graham, there's a lot of attention paid to the suicide rate in the military in 2008. To what extent do you think the increase in suicides that we've seen are related to the repeated deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's clearly hard on soldiers and their families. I don't think there's any question about it. I think that's pretty well understood that this is hard. These are hard times for our nation and for our Army. And the leaders of our Army have said our Army is stressed, and it is, and the families are too. And those, some of that's why it's so even more important now that we're aware of the warning signs. To when you see that, and I call it a crescendo. When you see that crescendo coming of risk factors and warning signs, we need to get in early and intervene early to assist the soldier and this family.
You took command of Fort Carson, I believe, in September of 2007. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, there's been a fair amount of some criticism and controversy surrounding the treatment of some servicemen at Fort Carson. There was a piece in Salon, the online magazine, about a soldier who had tape-recorded a session with a psychiatrist, and he had tape-recorded it because he had a short-term memory loss. According to the story, the psychiatrist confessed to him that he had been getting pressure to downgrade diagnosis so that soldiers were not diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which would suggest that you know, there was a way – in a way, mental health issues weren't being taken as seriously as they should have been, perhaps to save money in treatment and benefits. What do you make of that case?
Well, I'll tell you, when I found out about that, and it was summer of 08 that I found out about it. I think it was on the 2nd of July, actually. And when I found out about it, I reported that up quickly up the chain of command through the medical chain, as well as up the normal chain of command, to make leaders at higher levels aware. And the concern was if one provider would have said, you know, something like this provider said, would have been one thing. But when the provider said that they all were feeling this pressure, that to me was a red flag and a concern. So we raised the issue up. The Army Medical Command immediately decided to do a 15-6 investigation on this, and they sent someone from Department of the Army level. So it was not even not a Fort Carson person, but not even from the medical region. It was a person out of Washington that came down here. So they were very removed from the situation and came down and did an investigation and interviews and talked to determine what is there something here? I mean, what's going on here? And they did that. They came out and looked at this and made some determinations. I have not seen that report, but I know others have. And they made a determination that they did not see any evil or wrongdoing there on the part of that. There were some challenges, and part of it was the documentation to determine PTSD. But the Army made a change in December of 08. That changed the criteria for determining PTSD and the diagnosis of PTSD.
Right.
And I can't tell you the results of that, but intuitively, I think what you'll see is that will solve some of those challenges. Now, that doesn't mean it's all going to get corrected and to satisfaction of some, but I mean, I think it'll be easier now for them to show PTSD because of the requirement. There's a requirement that was in there before that's now been taken out.
Yeah. I mean, just to finish the record on this, I mean, Salon said in their follow-up interviews, it appears that the Army investigation actually did not include an interview of the psychiatrist who was tape-recorded saying that he had been pressured to change the diagnosis or the person who had headed the Department of Behavioral Health there. Do you feel like you have to battle with people in the Army command structure to get these issues taken seriously?
No, I don't. I mean, I certainly don't think I have to battle with them. I think we work through these together. And part of my job as the senior commander here is to raise these level issues to the senior levels so that they can look at these, as in this investigation did, so they can look at these independently.
You've said that there are encouraging signs in the way the Army is dealing with issues of stress and mental illness and suicide prevention. Are there things you see that tell you the military still has some work to do in this area?
Well, we're still having suicides. Will we ever stop all suicides? I'm an optimist, but frankly, I don't think we will. One's too many. So I think that is a sign that, you know, we're still losing soldiers, and losing one soldier to suicide is too many. Sergeant Major of the Army Preston has said that himself. He said, you know, losing one soldier to suicide is one too many. To me, that's the indicator is how do we help these soldiers and families and keep helping them to prevent suicides, but also to get them help from behavioral health issues.
Well, General Graham, I want to tell you that we certainly honor the sacrifice of your two sons and wish you and your family the best. And thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, you're welcome. And if I could, before you sign off, at the graveside of my son, Jeff and Kevin, after we buried our son, Jeff, who was killed in Iraq, my wife and I went back to the graveside the next morning, and at the graveside, someone had left a banner with a magic marker written on a banner hung next to the graveside of our boys. And on that banner, it said, "Land of the Free because of the Brave." And I certainly believe that. And to this day, we don't know who put the banner there. But in everything I do and everything I say and write, I put on there now, Land of the Free because of the brave, and I'll use it the rest of my life because I think this is the land of the free because of the brave, and I think both my boys were brave men.
Major General Mark Graham is a 32-year veteran of the Army and commander of Fort Carson, Colorado.